You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This week, a major milestone in genetics. Scientists unveiled the complete sequence of the human genome. Now, I know you hear saying, wait. 3 years ago, I heard on Science Friday, you did that story. 3 years ago, we heard about the Human Genome Project and they unraveled the human genome. What happened? Well, yes, they did. But if you listened carefully back then, what the project announced was the draft sequence, the first whack at it. Well, this week in the journal Nature, they've published the most complete sequence yet of the human genome. And if you're a purist, you'd have to say that this, too, is not the last word. Some of the genome is still unsequenced, and we'll find out why a bit later. What scientists have discovered from the sequence, though, is kind of surprising. They now say that the total number of genes we humans have has been lowered from that already eyebrow-raising 30,000 down to somewhere in the neighborhood of 20, 25,000. And that puts humans on par with the number of genes in a fish, the puffer fish, to be exact. Don't you see the resemblance? Well, we'll talk about why this is with scientists involved in that venture and why the really hard part yet to come is learning just what all these genes do. How will knowing the sequence of the human genome change our understanding of human health and disease? And if you'd like to participate in the discussion, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. Francis Collins is the director of the National Human Genome Research Institute of the NIH in Bethesda. He joins us today by phone from the campus of Stanford University in Stanford, California. Welcome to the program, Dr. Collins. I don't know how we've avoided having you on all these years.
Well, I don't either, but it's awfully nice to finally make your program. I'm excited to be here.
Thank you. Okay, let's go to the next. Evan Eichler is an associate professor of genome sciences at the University of Washington in Seattle, and he joins us today from KUOW in Seattle. Welcome to the program, Dr. Eichler.
It's great to be here.
Thank you. Eddie Rubin is the director of the U.S. Department of Energy Joint Genome Institute at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab in Berkeley. He joins us today from California. Welcome to the program, Dr. Rubin.
Okay, nice to be here, Ira.
Well, Dr. Collins, let's talk about this. What happened? We always thought you had the human genome sequenced. What's different about this one?
Well, what we had, as you said in your introduction, was a draft that was incredibly useful because it contained 90% of the information, but there was that 10% missing, and the 90% we had still had a lot of glitches, places where it wasn't put together quite right, gaps and so on. Anybody who's ever remodeled their kitchen would tell you that the sort of first draft part goes pretty well. That's the finishing that's the killer. And that's what we've been doing for the last 3 years now, trying to get this in a much better shape. And we have done so. Now the average segment of DNA that's complete, that has its sequence correct to no more errors than one out of every 100,000 letters of the codes, is about 40 million base pairs, about the length of an average chromosome arm. So this is now a beautiful sequence, one that the scientific community can depend on to be highly accurate and that they can build their research on for decades, maybe centuries to come.
Well, it's interesting. It's refreshing to hear you compare the Human Genome Project to kitchen cabinets. That's kind of let's talk about what the sequence has discovered. And I think the major headline we've seen around is that it looks like there are much even fewer genes, only 20, 25,000 genes.
Well, what about that? Huh?
What about that?
So, yeah, and as you also point out, there's another paper in Nature this week coming out with almost exactly that same estimate for the puffer fish, a particular vertebrate that we might imagine is not nearly as fancy as we are. And, of course, you can look around at genome projects that have been done for other species and find things like the mustard weed that seems to have about 25,000 genes and the roundworm that has about 19,000. So if we wanted to claim our special attributes on this planet come from the gene count, we've taken a serious hit. On the other hand, we're still pretty fancy organisms. None of these others have sequenced their own genome yet, so there must be some other explanation for how this all works.
All right, we'll get to that explanation in a little bit. Let me bring in Eddie Rubin. The project skipped over those parts of the genome that don't code for genes. What do we know about those parts? Why are they left out? Are they dead? We don't care about them?
Yeah, well, that's the non-coding part of the genome, which is about 98% of the genome. And so we've had a very gene-centric view of it, and so we've really focused on gene numbers, but there's most of the genome isn't coding for genes. And we're thinking that maybe information embedded in that non-genic part of the genome is contributing to the complexity that we see in humans and distinguish us from...
That's fascinating. 97% of the genome doesn't correspond to protein coding.
Right.
But we don't know what it does either.
Right. Well, we have some clues, and in fact, there have been lots of genome projects, and one of the powers that we have to begin to decipher or what the information encoded in genomes is by comparing genomes. And I think that the pufferfish and the mouse genome, by comparing them, we see what has been preserved in evolution are the genes, but also we see segments of this non-genic material, this non-coding DNA, that's also been preserved in evolution. And frequently those regions do things, and the things they do can be switches that turn genes on and off and sort of wiring diagrams. And so we're more than just, you know, 25 or 20,000 genes. We're also this other circuitry that's embedded within our genomes.
I have to point out the symmetry that I see in all of this between nature in meaning biology and nature meaning physics, because we have 96% of the universe made of dark energy and matter that we don't know what that is either.
Right, right. No. I'm surrounded by physicists, and I think we're going to figure out our part sooner than they are their part.
Dr. Collins, you agree?
Yeah, to a certain degree, and I also agree with Eddie. Yeah, we're on the path to figuring out what that 97% or 98.5%, I think it is, of the genome that doesn't code for protein does. And one of the most powerful tools is having all these other sequences from other genomes. By this time next year or so, we'll have a pretty good drafts of a dozen and a half or so other vertebrates, and those comparisons are incredibly useful. Evolution is not a sloppy experimentalist, at least not the forms that manage to survive. So when you look at the comparisons, it really does tell you what's functionally important, even though it doesn't tell you exactly what the function is.
Our number 1-800-989-8255, talking about the human genome sequence. Let me bring in Dr. Eichler. You compared this finished sequence to the sequence produced by Celera. What was the reason for doing that?
Yeah, this was the first time that we really had the opportunity to look at two genomes from the same species done really in two completely different ways. One was done with a method that the private developed, or at least was instrumental in getting put forward, which is called whole genome shotgun sequence approach, which effectively meant that they took the entire human genome and they broke it up into millions and millions of small pieces, sequenced those pieces, and tried to reassemble them as one big project. Mm-hmm. Now, the public effort did it a very different way. They took the genome, broke it down into 30,000 smaller projects, and each of those projects had information in terms of where it positioned within the genome. So the strategy here was to solve each of those 30,000 projects first and then reassemble the genome, and that was called a clone ordered approach. And the reason it's what we specifically looked at was to look at how well they did specifically in the very difficult regions of the genome, areas where there's large blocks of sequence that are duplicated multiple times. And you know, the motivation was essentially to understand which method would work better. And you know, the clone-ordered approach worked much better in these regions. The private initiative effectively lost about 100 megabases of sequence, which is, you know, 100 million base pairs of sequence in these duplicated regions. And that's about a chromosome's worth of sequence that was lost.
And so you can't depend on one over the other then, at least not on...
Yeah, I mean, it's the clone...
That's the lesson, the take-home lesson here. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Let's talk about where you go from here, because it would seem to me that... the genome sequencing was the easy part. Even though it took a lot of work, it was sort of an engineering project. Now trying to figure out what all these genes do, why you have so few many, how they interact, why we're not a fish, all that kind of stuff would seem to be, Dr. Collins, the hard part.
It is indeed, and I think it's fair to say what we have right now is the end of the beginning, and we've already moved into the hard part of trying to understand function, and there are several powerful ways to do that that are now being explored. One is this comparison of the DNA sequences of multiple different organisms, particularly vertebrates, but also now lots of primates, trying to figure out from evolution's lab notebook which parts of our genome seem to be most functionally important. We also have a collaborative project that just got underway about 9 months ago, where we have dozens of groups that are interested in understanding the genome and how it works, working together to compare various experimental approaches as well as computational approaches to try to define what are these regulatory signals in the genome that we know must be there. How do they work? What binds to them? What are the signals that determine chromosome structure? All of these motifs that are not part of protein coding but must be really critical for how the genome functions. And that project's coming along pretty well, to the point where I think we can see our path forward to beginning to understand in a very digital way that a chemist or a physicist would approve of how it is that life works. And that is, after all, the goal. Now, that, of course, is only part of the story. As a physician, the part that I'm most interested in is figuring out how glitches in the genome result in a risk of disease and how we could do something about that in terms of prevention or development of new therapies. And that also is a major focus of the effort, trying to look at that small proportion of the DNA, only about 0.1%, where people differ from each other, knowing that somewhere in there are the clues to why some people are at risk for breast cancer, as in your early segment, or at heart disease or diabetes or so on. And that is a very major emphasis now in this next phase of understanding the genome.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones to Tallahassee, Florida. Hi, Robert. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi.
I don't know if this question has already been answered or not, but what exactly is a genome?
Well, the genome is all of the DNA of an organism. You know, DNA is this wonderful hereditary material, the instruction book of all living organisms. It's made up of base pairs, these rungs on the ladder of the double helix. And the genome, which is sort of a funny word and one that most people have trouble pronouncing, is just all of the DNA of that organism. Our genome, the human genome, is about 3 billion of those letters. In fact, about 3.05 billion. We now have a better fix on that.
Do you know how long it would take to decipher the code of an entire genome?
So in order to do this, and the paper that's published this week, it took about 2 years to get the draft, and it took about another 3 years to get it all cleaned up and finished. But, of course, that was with the technology that we had then. Things have moved very rapidly. You could now get this whole information derived from scratch in the matter of perhaps 4 or 5 months. And we aim by, you know, 2010 or 2015 to be able to derive any person's genome for less than $1,000 and to be able to do that in a couple of weeks. So things are moving on.
Okay, Robert?
Okay.
Good luck to you. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
1-800-989-8255. What do you think, and I'll ask, starting with you, Dr. Collins, which part, if you have to now dissect and pick out a piece of the genome you want to work on the most, which part are you going to choose and why?
Well, it's a good question, and this collaboration that I mentioned where we have all these groups working together to try to figure out what really does work to identify the functional parts, we wanted to pick a representative part of the genome and have everybody work on that, not try to do the whole thing at once. So we picked 1%, but it's a very carefully chosen 1%. It's got some gene-rich regions, some gene-poor regions. It's got regions that seem to be evolving rapidly and others that are rather slow, and that 1% has become the most intensely studied part of our own instruction book, and I think that's turned out to be pretty useful. But, of course, it's not from one chromosome. It's from several different places around different chromosomes with lots of genes located within them.
We're talking about the Human Genome Project this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Dr. Rubin, I'm still fascinated by these non-coding parts of the genome. You did that study. What were the questions that you're asking besides the obvious ones? You know, why these? Is it dead stuff there? What are the questions you're looking to answer?
Okay, let me give you a little background in that. If you look at the sequence of the human genome as well as genomes from other organisms, that there are large stretches of non-genic material that are sometimes called deserts,
right.
Gene deserts, lacking genes. And looking and comparing these deserts in different organisms, we see that they come in different flavors. And there's one flavor where you don't have genes, but there are sequences that have been preserved in evolution all the way down to fish, even though it's not a gene. And people have studied these, and they've shown that those deserts do encode function, and that function frequently is vital for the organism.
If they're not a gene, what do you call them?
Well, sometimes it's called a conserved sequence,
uh-huh.
and it's conserved because something is binding frequently to that region, and proteins will bind to that region and turn on genes far away from that region. And so they're sometimes called regulatory elements.
I got you.
But there's another flavor of these deserts, and those are ones that was in this recent Nature issue, was where there are, if you compare these non-genic intervals, that you don't see preservation of sequences deep in evolution. And those were the deserts that I've been particularly interested in. And the question is, do they have any function? And so the approach to it is, or the approach to it that we took, was a little bit like a builder. If you have a wall and you remove it and the ceiling falls in, then it's weight-bearing and it's quite important. And so you can explore these deserts in a similar way, in that you can go to the mouse genome and remove these, using tools of genetic engineering, move these large segments and see what happens to the mouse. And we looked at some of these deserts that were not preserved in evolution, saw in some ways, the short of it was the mouse's ceiling didn't fall in, and they didn't have that much impact.
So you got a negative answer, but it told you something.
Well, it suggests that maybe there are regions of the genome that don't have that much function, and that maybe you can mess with them. And
why would nature keep putting them back in?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question, and maybe it's not that much energy to add additional sequence. And the possibility that you'll eventually wind up with something that's useful is worth the extra energy you put into it. You know, it's like writing a book. You know, you can get the same amount of information, a really short book, and you can, without that much effort, you can write a much longer book which has the same information. And so it's almost harder to write, to be fastidious.
But Eddie, isn't there another possible interpretation, just to be sure we've got all the options on the table, and that is that these segments, while they don't show conservation down to fish, they do often show elements in them that appear to have been cared about by evolution of mammals. So is it possible that, in fact, these are subtle effects, so maybe the ceiling didn't fall in when you knocked this out, but it sagged a bit, and your efforts to detect that were not as precise as they might be because you're looking at a mouse and it's hard to score the mouse's function?
Yeah. No, I think that's the fundamental caveat, in that we are imprecise in our ability to assess how a mouse is. You know, the real way to do this experiment is to remove these sequences and let these mice with the abridged genome and with the normal genome run around your backyard and come back in 100 years and see if there's a difference. And we can't do that. And so clearly there are subtleties, but I think it does suggest that there are regions which probably have less dramatic activity than other regions. Mm-hmm. And it's not saying that they don't have any activity, but less dramatic.
Fascinating stuff. We have to take a break. Don't go away, because we'll come back and talk lots more with our guests, Eddie Rubin, Francis Collins, and also we're gonna take your calls and come right back and stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. You're listening to Doc of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about genetics and the human genome with my guest, Francis Collins, director of the National Human Genome Research Institute at NIH, Dr. Evan Eichler, associate professor of genome sciences at the University of Washington in Seattle, Dr. Eddie Rubin, director of the U.S. DOE Joint Genome Institute at the Lawrence Berkeley Labs in Berkeley, California. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones. David in Charlottesville, Virginia. Hi, David.
Hi. Nice to talk to Ira and your guests.
Thank you. Go ahead.
There's something that stuck in my mind that I read years ago that had to do with the history of evolutionary theory, in that the theory was really developed historically, and then DNA was discovered. And when you look at DNA among species, as you're talking about today, there's a remarkable amount of variety, even in the number of chromosomes and so on. So I was curious if your guests could comment on how much do you see as you look at the evolutionary tree vis-a-vis genetic changes that appear to have happened. Is it smooth, or is there a lot of this kind of variability, and what do they think about that?
Dr. Eichler, want to tackle that?
Yeah, I would say that we've looked at quite a bit recently comparing different primates with respect to human and their genome sequence, and the pattern of variation fits very, very nicely with the estimated timing of separation. So it's actually remarkable and very reassuring that when you compare a chimp and a human, you see that the sequence is 98% identical, or maybe 98.8% identical. When you compare a gorilla, it's 97% identical. When you compare an orangutan, it's 96, and so on. And so it's almost a beautiful reflection of evolutionary time that emerges from comparative genomic sequencing.
But what that also tells you, and also the fact that you've lowered the number of genes in the genome, means that these genes must have, what, dual purposes, or they're working together, or why are this? Why is it, you know, the human genome have the same number of genes as a fish? What's going on here? Well, how do you explain that?
I think you have to be very careful about the definition of a gene. One of the things that's clear from the studies that have been done is that most people's definition of a gene involves something that encodes a protein.
Right.
But we know that there are things that are in the genome that could qualify as a gene but just don't produce a functional protein. There's a number of investigators that work on different areas of the genome that produce RNA molecules, for example. So these are kind of intermediates from the DNA to the protein. They don't ever make a functional protein, but are in fact important in regulation of genes in a different genome. So these sequences could be very different, and we really don't know very much about them. And so I think we have to be careful in really how we define what is a gene and what isn't a gene, because we have a very narrow definition right now because we're very comfortable with it. We know a lot about it. But there are many other sequences out there that are potentially very important and could in some day be qualified or categorized as a gene.
So you're saying this 20 to 25,000 is a low number that you should, if we added in these other?
I think we've hit the bottom. I really do. I think that in 10 years from now, the number will start to creep up a bit. And if people open up their definitions, and if the definition of a gene changes, which is really the crux of the argument, we may in fact have a larger number again. So
yeah, we
hate
should
to
be,
waffle on this issue. But
no, it's not waffling at all.
We should be clear about what that number is supposed to be. So that is the number of protein coding genes. I completely agree with Evan that there may be another world of genes out there that code for RNAs that don't in turn code for proteins. We don't know how many of those there are. There might be quite a lot. I don't think the protein coding gene number is likely to go up much. I think we have better ways of recognizing those, and I don't think we've missed a lot of them. But the other kinds of genes, sure. And Ira, to answer your question, how do we achieve complexity with such a short list? There's other possible answers to that, too. Clearly, our proteins maybe are capable of multitasking, so you get away with lots of functions from a short list of instructions. But also, it's true that each human gene, on the average, makes about 3 proteins, using this mechanism called alternative splicing. And then, of course, you get all of the combinatorics that kick in by the fact that biology generally doesn't operate one protein at a time. It's from multi-component protein complexes. And then pretty soon you have an astronomical number of biological possibilities, and it begins to be imaginable that you might actually build a human nervous system out of that.
Are the genes in the sequence duplicated in different places? I mean, is there unnecessary duplication going on? That's two different questions, but Dr. Eichler?
Yeah, so I mean, it's one of the things that we're particularly fascinated with the human genome is that there are regions of the genome that are duplicated multiple times and very, very recently. So coming back to the last caller's question, while most of the sequence behaves as it should, in terms of divergence, in terms of how much sequence variation there is, these regions are very, very dynamic and plastic, and they change very, very quickly. And a lot of the sequences that are embedded in these duplications appear to be dead or dying genes, but some of them have signatures or features which suggest that they may be very, very important, perhaps in immune response, perhaps in development of sex cells and other things. So these are kind of black boxes right now that we and others are beginning to kind of peer into. Mm-hmm. And I will add that this is one of those great things that came from the Genome Project. We had inklings of this before, but when we had the complete finished sequence, we really had a wonderful kind of roadmap to all these funky regions of the genome.
Susan in Portland, Oregon. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, I'm interested in about the relationship between, you know, science and intellectual property rights, and followed a bit what happened with genomic information and the announcement by Blair, the political side, with Blair and Clinton saying this should be in the public domain. And I guess I'm trying to understand what happens when you start annotating the genome, and are those annotations going to be protected by intellectual property rights, and what does that mean for the sharing of the information and the moving of scientific, in scientific endeavor forward.
Dr.
Sure.
Collins?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the International Human Genome Sequencing Consortium that's publishing this finished sequence today has from the beginning felt very strongly that this fundamental information about the genome ought to be in the public domain. And that's why all of the sequence has been put up on the Internet every 24 hours from the very beginning, and we're very happy now that the world's scientists, wherever they happen to be, have immediate access without any barriers or subscription fees whatsoever. similarly, the annotation in terms of deciding is this a gene or not, is that a functional element or not, we believe should also be in the public domain. This consortium that I mentioned of investigators that are trying to do that functional annotation, and by the way, that's described in a paper today in Science magazine, have also agreed that all this data ought to be accessible, and so it's going up into a public database where anybody can see it. Now, we need to be careful, though, not to completely demonize intellectual property, because it does benefit the public in certain situations. If you've discovered something, for instance, that is going to be turned into a therapeutic, most companies aren't going to be interested in investing the hundreds of millions of dollars it takes to bring that to market unless they have some protection against competitors for a limited period of time, which is what a patent does. So we need to be sensible. If your discovery brings you on a pathway towards a treatment, and that's a treatment the public needs, then that may be a circumstance where intellectual property is highly appropriate. That, in fact, is what Clinton and Blair said about 3 or 4 years ago, even though it was widely misunderstood at the time.
So if you take something from the Genome Project and you're ready to make a product out of it, a drug or whatever, then it's patentable is what you're saying, and it should be.
Yeah, if you can show it has that kind of utility, novelty, and non-obviousness, then yes, it does meet the standard, and I think the public in general would be well served by having that patented so that the investment would be made in bringing that product to market.
Okay, Susan?
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go quickly another phone call to Randy in Dallas, Dallas, Wisconsin, right?
Yep.
All right, go ahead.
I'm kind of a science guy. I've grown up on science, so I have this kind of innate love for doing things just for the knowledge of it. And I definitely see the serious upsides in genetic research like this. It's, you know, the upsides are just phenomenal. But in my travels in science, I've also come to the realization that with the higher the upsides, the lower the downsides on them, potential downsides on them. For instance, in this, there was a comment, I think it was by Rove, maybe Rumsfeld, some time ago, about talking about a genetic bomb kind of thing. So what are we doing as a scientific community to inject brakes on the downside to these tremendous upsides?
Yeah, we always face a period where we're not quite sure, you know, certainly the history of genetic research has had a period like that. I'm thinking of Asilomar back in 1974. Let me remind everybody first that I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Gentlemen?
So, yeah, let me jump in as Francis Collins, because I think this is a very important area, very important question, and one where the Genome Project distinguished itself from the very beginning by deciding to set aside a proportion of the budget to study these ethical, legal, and social implications of the advances in understanding the genome. That's a new experiment. It hasn't been done that way. In the past, science has generally gone forward, and then suddenly one day somebody says, oh my gosh, do you see what we might be about to step into? And there's a crisis, and everybody runs around and tries to figure out what to do. In this instance, it's been done very prospectively, and that funding program now supports a cohort of scholars, law experts, social scientists, ethicists, that have pretty much drawn up a roadmap of what the major issues are and what we need to do to avoid bad outcomes. And those range from things like passing legislation to prevent genetic discrimination, which we're close to seeing happen in the United States Congress, if the House will take action on the bill that the Senate has already passed unanimously, to things like trying to decide what are the boundaries where genetic technology shouldn't be utilized, to this issue about even using genetics in bioterrorism approaches. Many of the scenarios that people put forward are scientifically not very plausible, but there are some that really deserve that kind of attention. And while I wouldn't say you could say confidently that we have put in place all kinds of preventive measures so that nothing bad would ever happen, I think we're pretty far along in at least identifying the major potential for mischief and doing something about it.
And it's interesting that you talk about this, because before you know, this is something we need to think about, because you mentioned before how you within 10 years you can, for $1,000, get your whole human, your own personal genome.
Imagine what that will be like, and that will be potentially part of your regular medical care, and obviously you want to be quite sure who has access to that information and what they're going to do with it so it doesn't get used against you, and that's a major area of current interest in our ethical, legal, and social issues component of our program.
Sure, because if you see that you may be vulnerable to any kind of disease, you may have trouble getting, you know, health insurance, things like that.
Well, indeed. And we all have these glitches. If listeners to NPR Science Friday imagine that they're the perfect specimens, I'm sorry to tell you there aren't any. So we're all at risk for something. We are coming towards a time where people can find out that information if they want to know. And I think a lot of people will want to know if it allows them to practice better individualized preventive medicine, focusing on the things that matter the most to them and having a better chance to stay healthy.
Is this your personal genome that was decoded?
That's exactly what we would imagine possible in another 10 or 15 years.
But the genome that was decoded today.
Yes.
Whose genome is that?
Oh, whose is that? Yeah. Well, it belongs to a series of four or five individuals who answered a newspaper ad in a northeastern city, came in and gave a blood sample and agreed to this sequencing of their DNA. But I will tell you that about 100 people showed up, and we only used the DNA from four or five of them, and we don't even know which ones they are intentionally. So we're not sure who these people are, but they're diverse in their backgrounds, and they basically now represent all of us.
And Eddie Rubin, would we compare these genomes to other genomes of other animals?
Sure.
Yeah,
you know, what we do is by comparing in evolution, we look for regions which are similar, mm-hmm. and those tell us where if people have variations in regions which have been conserved deep in evolution, then those are regions which may have an impact. And there are other regions of the genome where there's variation amongst individuals, where those other regions may not have been conserved in evolution, and there's a greater likelihood that variation doesn't have any role in or has a lower probability of having a role in biology.
So this comparison and the human genome is a great tool to use to talk to people about the validity of evolution.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. All right, gentlemen, we've run out of time. I'd like to thank all of you this hour. Francis Collins, director of the National Human Genome Research Institute at the NIH in Bethesda. Evan Eichler, associate professor of genome sciences at the University of Washington in Seattle. And Eddie Rubin, director of the U.S. Department of Energy Joint Genome Institute at Lawrence Berkeley Lab in Berkeley, California. Have a great weekend. Thank you all for taking time to talk with us today.
Hey, thanks, Ira.
Well, thank you, Ira.
You're welcome.
Okay.
You're welcome. Thanks. See you all again. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galek, Paul Masiello, and Rigo Cardi in New York, and Doug Patterson in Seattle. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today, and we need it, as always, from NPR librarians Kim Molesky and Alphonse Finn. And if you missed any of the references, if you like the Genome Project, you'd like to make some teaching materials out of it for your kids, go over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we have a kids connection. Just click on the teachers button on the left side, and within a few days up there will be the teaching curricula you can use free of charge to use in teaching the Human Genome Project to your kids in school. Also, download on your Audible player, and maybe on your iPod there, Science Friday back editions, or listen to them on Real Audio. And any other links we talked about today should be up there, including the program for breast cancer. So check that out, and you'll have an easy time finding all of that stuff. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.